Good morning. This is Nancy Williams for Petals and Prose. And because we're approaching Halloween, I thought it would be really cool to read you an interesting essay about spiders, which are kind of Halloween-y. This is from one of my favorite books, Sue Hubbell's A Country Year, Living the Questions. And I love spiders, and so this works. I really do. I have to confess. I think they're fascinating. I don't like them if they bite me, but most of them won't bite you. And this has to do with some of the most fascinating ones that we have and that people actually ask me about once in a while. This is what Sue has to say about spiders. There is a magnificent dappled brown and gold house spider changing her skin today in a corner up above the wood stove. A spider grows by molting its skin, which doubles as a skeleton. My spider spent yesterday quietly in her corner getting it all together and feeling a bit uncomfortable, I suppose, for I read that spiders raise their blood pressure in molt. It has taken her the best part of the morning to crawl out of her old skin, and now she is hanging beside it, resting from the effort, which must have been considerable. Her old skin is beginning to shrivel. It looks wispy and impossibly small for this fine new spider to have worn. She is big, more than half an inch, but not as large as a similar house spider I have seen in the kitchen, so she probably has more molts to go before she reaches her full size. Molting is one answer to the problem posed by growth. Not mine, to be sure, but no less correct an answer for all that. Biologists like to emphasize that growth from the inside out is one of the characteristics that separates things that are alive from those that are not. Crystals which are not alive grow, but they do so by accretion, simply adding new material to what is already there. Human beings and other mammals who hang their soft body parts onto and outside a skeleton never have to face the growth problems of creatures such as insects, grasshoppers, or the honeybees out in my beehives, or spiders, which are not insects at all but arachnids. Growth does present certain difficulties, but they are different ones. Spiders, grasshoppers, and honeybees, or lobsters for that matter, wear their skeleton on the outside, and so when they grow too tight, they must find some means to shed them. Many insects follow molts with metamorphosis, a complete and radical dissolution of the old body form and rearrangement into a new one. But spiders just step out of their skeletons, doing so anywhere from 2 to 20 times before they're grown, but keeping the same relative form. Baby spiders, unlike many baby insects, look like the adults, but smaller. One night when I turned on a light in my cabin, I found a mother wolf spider with her back covered with babies. Most spiders don't have much interest in their young, but wolf spiders carry them around wherever they go. When the spiderlings emerge from their egg sac, they crawl up on the mother's back and cling to her. The ones I watched, tiny, delicate, perfect miniatures, were an unruly lot and appeared to be causing her no end of trouble. They crawled over her eyes and she had to brush them away. They jostled one another and several tumbled off onto the floor and then scurried to climb up her legs and return to the security of her back. The wolf spider and the house spider are both big as spiders go. An outside skeleton imposes mechanical limits on the size of a body that can function nicely. But other, even larger spiders are common in my garden. The black and yellow argiopes, which spin distinctive webs that look as if they had zippers in them. They are brilliant, glossy, stylish spiders, and out there in the garden they trap grasshoppers that eat my tomatoes. They spin winding sheets around the insects and store them until they're needed, like thrifty housewives stocking the larder. It's a way of making a living, of which I thoroughly approve, the sort of thing that makes us label the spider as beneficial while condemning the grasshopper as harmful. I'll admit that I wasn't nearly so pleased one day when I discovered a black and yellow argiope who had spun her web in front of one of my beehives and had stocked her particular larder with tidily wrapped honeybees who had flown directly into it on their way home, heavily laden with their loads of nectar. I destroyed her web and moved her over to a bush, where I hoped she would find something to eat that pleased her equally, and me rather more. Web-weaving spiders don't see very well by our standards. They are so nearsighted that when the males come courting, they pluck the strands of the female's web to announce their arrival in order not to be taken for tasty morsels. So I doubt that the beehive Argiope was able to see me when I moved her. In a way, that was a pity, because for all of our differences, we share something important. We are both beekeepers. Both of us make a living from the bees. My way, compared to hers, seems excessively Byzantine. I cosset the bees all year long, take away their extra honey, process it, bottle it, truck it to New York to sell to Bloomingdale's, and then use the check to buy things I need. She simply eats bees. We are both animate bundles of the chemicals common to all living things. Carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, sulfur, and phosphorus. Both of us have been presented with a set of problems posed by our chemistry and quickness. Among them, how to grow and how to make a living. Those are big questions. And as often the case with big questions, we have come up with different answers. Answers that in turn are still different from those of the honeybee, who is a similar chemical bundle and upon whom we both depend for a living. The honeybee's solutions have more to do with metamorphosis and the nectar of flowers, and those answers are good ones, too. Living in a world where the answers to questions can be so many and so good is what gets me out of bed and into my boots every morning. This, again, is from Sue Hubble's book, A Country Year, Living the Questions. I thought, since this is sort of a spiders and Halloween piece to read to you today, that the best recipe that I could give you would be for candy. This is much better than that store-bought Halloween candy. You probably couldn't give it to your trick-or-treaters, but you could give it to you, and you could have it at your Halloween party. And in celebration of Sue Hubble's bees and mine, it is a recipe for honey milk chocolate fudge. So good, so easy. Here we go. It yields a little over 2 pounds. You need 18 ounces of semi-sweet chocolate and 1/4 teaspoon of salt, 1.5 teaspoons of honey, 1 1/3 cups of condensed milk, that is a 15-ounce can, and 1/2 cup of coarsely chopped nut meats. You butter or line an 8-inch square pan or the equivalent with wax paper or foil. I always just butter the pan. Melt the chocolate in the top of a double boiler over hot water. Stir and remove from the heat when melted. Add the salt, honey, and condensed milk. Stir it up to make a smooth mixture. If you like, add the nuts. Pour the fudge into the prepared pan, spread it evenly in the pan, smooth out the top. If you like, decorate it with more nuts, either crunched up nuts in little tiny pieces or half a walnut, put them 1/2 inch apart. Refrigerate it for at least 2 hours, cut into squares. Keep refrigerated, but remove from refrigeration about 20 minutes before you want to serve it. That is like the easiest fudge recipe in the world. Even your 5-year-old can make it if you stand there and watch them. Enjoy it, and you can find this recipe on the UPR website, upr.org, under the Zesty Garden. See you next time.